Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of What's the Brew. I am joined today with mental health clinician, motivational speaker, and author, Bernard Owens. How are you?
Good, man. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I want to start with the mental health side. How did you get into mental health? Why was that important for you?
You know, like a lot of the people that I work with in mental health, my work in mental health started with a journey to figure myself out. And then once I started to get tools to do that in an effective way, realized that I could help other people and had a talent for actually doing that. So that's what led me to do that. I've been doing mental health coaching and wellness and support for about a decade now after finishing Candler School of Theology here in Atlanta at Emory.
Okay. Yes. And they say like one of the hardest things with mental health, from my understanding, is being able to turn that lens on yourself first before trying to address someone else. Did you find the same challenges?
So it's a different type of turning the lens on yourself when you're a clinician or when you work in the field.
Okay.
It's like, you know, asking an open heart surgeon to perform their own surgery. It's just not a good idea, right? So so you have an awareness of things that are going on in the body if you work in this field and have that study in you. Mm-hmm. But it's not a good idea to try to diagnose yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's a difference, a slight difference. It's awareness. But in terms of other people, you can always read and pick up either vibes or, you know, see things from a mile away that the other people aren't always able to see.
Have you always had that ability to do that? Was that something that you developed as a kid?
I come from a long line of empaths and intuitive folks.
Okay.
So to be able to couple that with the real world skills of being a mental health clinician is what makes me effective as a clinician.
I want to be nosy now. Who in the family was like an empath? Like, so, is that the whole family? Like mom's side, dad's side?
My mother's side primarily. My mother, okay. Her sister, and my mother and both of her sisters. My mother would expect a phone call from me after thinking about me earlier in the day, no matter how long it had been since we spoke. I knew you would call today. And vice versa. Particularly my mom was stronger with her and her younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Is that something, when you're younger, do you run away from that? Because that can be heavy.
It can be, and I think that's what caused me a lot of mental anguish at an earlier age. I talk about in the book how my first suicide attempt was at 11 years old, man.
11.
Because I was feeling so many things, not just my issues, but feeling other people. When you're an empath, you can look at a person across the room. I have to temper myself now. I can go to a Target, and if somebody's looking a certain kind of way, either they'll come up to me or I would ask them, and it's like, where's the tide? I don't work in Target. I don't know where the tide is, but I can pick up the energy from across the room. So
right.
It's a gift. It really is a gift. You just have to protect yourself that you're not helping too many people. I'd say that something for yourself and recharging your own battery.
Yeah, because are there points like you feel it and you're like, not today? Like, no, not walking towards that one.
Yeah, I think everybody's different, but I am charismatic, but an introvert by nature. So I'm mm-hmm. happiest with a bowl of ice cream, watching Netflix by myself in a cool, dark room, right? But I also have the ability to be charismatic in a room of people because I enjoy that, just not long periods of it. So you won't have me probably hear me calling anybody saying, when's the next party?
yeah,
but I will go, you know, I will go. Because you have to, when you're an empath like that and you pick up all the energy in the room, you have to isolate yourself sometimes because you absorb it.
So who or what would be your outlet? Like, who do you go to when you're having your own problems or your own issues, like mental health states?
I wholeheartedly endorse mental health therapy for everybody, particularly those of us working in the field, because in a 12 and a half hour shift, I can hear more about suicide, loss, trauma than most people hear in their whole lives. So yeah. You need someplace professionally, preferably, to go and get that off of you. It's like a residue that can be on you after you finish a shift helping people in that way. So the great thing about technology now is I just flip my laptop open once every other week and process those things with my own therapist.
Nice.
And it's been very helpful.
Nice, nice. Now, to jump back, you said you were 11 the first time you attempted to commit suicide.
Yeah.
I guess what drove you to that, and then how did you bounce back afterwards? Or do you feel like you bounce back afterwards?
You know, I think what drove me to that is now in hindsight, right? I was 11. I attempted death by suicide. It was not successful. my stomach was pumped, you know, there wasn't much discussion about it. And so I was living in public housing with my mother, and then I went right back into the school system and it wasn't addressed. Come to find out, there was a history of suicidality and depression that runs through my family on my mother's side, particularly with our mother. Now, I never knew that, but I'm a strong believer that traits can be passed along through DNA. Yeah. Whether we know the story or not, they still live within us sometimes. So at 11, that wasn't addressed. I went on, there was chronic childhood depression, which could have been situational. I was living in public housing with my mom after living in a middle-class existence, not knowing where I fit in, and it just wasn't addressed. So at 21, I had a second suicide attempt at Michigan State University in the dorm, where they kicked the door open and took me out on a stretcher, and I began my process of healing, because one of the conditions of continuing at the university was that I get into mental health therapy, and it was a tremendous blessing to me.
Yeah.
That
was some 30 years ago.
So I know that, especially within our community, like the Black community, if somebody is attempting suicide, they're often looked at as just trying to get attention.
Yeah.
Is that something that you had to battle with? And if so, like when you realized what it was, with it not being addressed, is that something that you felt like hurt you long run?
You know, there's a saying in our field, like, instead of saying people are attention seeking, that they are connection seeking, right? So maybe in my opinion, I wasn't looking for attention. I was looking for connection. I was looking for help. You're 11. You don't know where your next meal is going to come from. Your mom's a single mom working three jobs, trying to date after being newly divorced and meeting different people and those people coming into the household and you fighting with them. All of those things no 11-year-old should have to deal with. But I do think that the adultification, which is, you know, a term we use, of young people, particularly young Black people, happens more and more. And so we are shouldering the burden of folks who didn't have the benefit of therapy for themselves. So they're just doing what they're doing, but not realizing how that can impact the child. So there was a lot to deal with at the time. And it definitely wasn't just a cry for help. It was more than that. It was a cry for relief for saving.
Yeah. Yeah. When you get past that college moment,
yeah,
how do you see the trajectory of your life for yourself looking forward? Like, what did you think was going to come next?
You know, honestly, I was optimistic after the event. And once I started therapy, I was optimistic because now nothing's holding me back. Everybody knows now that I walk around telling jokes, but I'm really sad and in a lot of ways dying inside. Now I don't have to pretend. I don't have to make other people happy. I don't have to do as much as I used to do. Now I can focus on myself, which hadn't been the case. I was worried about everybody else from 8 years old, emotionally cared for my mom, and then financially, and then, you know, before she passed away, I was even her legal guardian. So there's a lot to shoulder. And I think a lot of Black folks deal with some of the same things. It's just not talked about. And so when we talk about attention seeking or suicidality or suicide being cowardly, some people use with the stigma associated with it. I think it's one of the, you got to have balls to try to kill yourself. And you really got to have balls to be unsuccessful, because now you have to deal with all the eyes that are looking at you when you didn't make it happen the way you thought it was going to happen.
Yeah. It's weird, because I was just having a conversation with one of my close friends. We're talking about her kid. And I was saying that, you know, people oftentimes are smiling outside like horrible inside, and then tell everyone they're all right.
Yeah.
And ultimately, all that does is like protects your trauma. So whatever's going on, you're basically saying like, that's okay. It's okay to like live feeling like this, like to have that, you know, disappointment, anger, aggression, whatever. And then just saying to yourself that that's okay because I'm okay.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a way to kind of address that without walking around with like your full emotion on the front of your face?
Yeah. I think two things come to mind when you ask that, right? The first is, as African-American men, we are not always afforded the luxury of letting people know or even being accepted or heard when we say something is bothering us.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times I was told, not just by my family, but people in society, to man up, to pull your pants up, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. All of those things that we say to, particularly to young men, in terms of how we're supposed to move through the world, suck it up, shake it off. And nobody really tells you how to do that.
Uh-huh.
So that's the first part of your question. And I think the latter part I may have lost.
No, like, is are you able to address that? Are you able to like to live in your truth without, I guess, seeming depressed to other people because you're actually expressing your emotions?
Yeah, you know, the beautiful thing about it is now you, once you get over that, you really just don't care, right? And so part of my second attempt was not only shouldering the burden of other people as an empath, but shouldering how you navigate being gay and Black at a predominantly white institution where there aren't a lot of resources at the time. So all of those things and all of that pressure. But like I said, once the cork was out of the bottle, I began to live my life for myself and still care for other people, but put my own mental well-being first. And, you know, it's kind of like the ding from the airplane. I was a flight attendant for a long time. When the mask drops, put your own mask on first, then you can help everybody else.
Yeah.
I think that's something that we need to stress more. Take care of yourself, not because you're selfish, but take care of yourself because once you do that, you can take care of everybody else around you.
Yeah. Effectively. And I think that's it's important because we often tell ourselves that being selfless and giving ourselves to other people and like trying to be there for everyone is the optimal way to go. But ultimately, like, you're harming yourself because you're not giving yourself any of that care at all. Mm-hmm. So like you're hurting, but you're making sure everybody else is good. And you're like kind of smiling in public and then crying in private.
Right.
Like it's a dangerous space to kind of just exist in.
And I think that people who know that you're the one that can clean things up and take care of things count on you to clean things up and take care of things. And they don't ask you how you do it.
Yeah.
For a couple of reasons. They assume that you're okay. And two, if you told them that you were, they wouldn't know what to do with it. So that's why it's your responsibility to take care of yourself.
That's interesting. I never thought about the not knowing what to do with someone who typically is always okay.
Yeah. Who always seems okay, right? One of the things I've been looking at in the latter part of my life is crafting friendships where people, I'm not only asking them how they're doing, they're asking me how I'm doing.
Yeah.
And so that's been important to me.
Yeah, I have this like a couple of friends from back home. Like that's one of our things is really truly asking how you're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and it's a how's your heart kind of question.
Yeah.
And because there's that vulnerability within that friendship, everybody's able to be very honest with that space and realizing that that's not something that a lot of people have access to.
Right.
I cherish that part of the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And the interesting thing about it is how often do we pass each other in the world and say, how you doing? Before you can even get it out, not that you would give your whole life story, people don't really care about how you're doing. You know, except for the circle.
Yeah.
They don't care because they're thinking about what they've got to do, what they need to take care of, their student loans, their children that they're trying to raise, their ailing parents. So it's not a callous thing, but people are focused on themselves and what they need to do.
Yeah.
And we'll seek out folks who are healers to help them take care of their problems. I just recently had a difficult time ending a friendship with someone who I was explaining something was going on with a friend of mine who had just been diagnosed with a terminal illness. And the friend I was telling it to pulled out her cell phone and started showing me pictures of herself in a onesie in the middle of our conversation with me trying to tell. And so I just was quiet. I just thought, oh, okay, this is not what's good for me. You
know? Yeah.
But you have to have those moments where you stop and not become argumentative or not make a grand declaration about not wanting to have the person in your life anymore, but you make a conscious decision for yourself.
You got to pull back.
You got to pull back.
And I think that's an important part of friendships and family relationships and having boundaries is just kind of realizing when something is off. And then just kind of stepping back from it for a minute and figure out what that is and then decide how you want to move forward instead of just sitting in it and dealing with it like it's supposed to be there.
Yeah. And I think the great thing about boundaries is you can realize something is off, even if the person that is off with doesn't realize it. You don't have to get into a conflict or struggle with them. You just know it's not working for you. Because once you get into a conflict or struggle with them, now you're trying to prove what you feel is right.
Yeah.
And you can't prove what you feel is right. What you feel is what you feel.
Okay. So you become an author. What made you write your first book?
This first book was birthed out of my relationship with my mother, who I talked a little bit about earlier. And so I have been her legal guardian for the last 2 years. And I knew there were things that I wanted to talk about since the 11 and 21 year old suicide attempts that have helped me that I could impart to other people. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know where to begin, or even if I had that in me, or the time to do it, right, or the resources. But as she became more, as her health started to decline, I realized that I needed to get that out. And also talk about how the relationship between my mother and myself was transformed by doing my own work. When you work on yourself, that's when the world transforms. You can't change other people, but you start changing yourself and everything transforms right in front of you. So to your question about the book, when I realized her health was declining and I started writing the book, I worked more on our relationship and healing things, wounds from 11 years old, all of those things. And so she passed away on September 23rd. It'll be a year coming up soon.
Okay.
And I was on the floor. She was in the hospital bed. I was holding her hand when she passed. And I'm telling you, that is not what would have happened had I not done the work on myself.
Yeah.
And I don't have any regret. I don't have any remorse because I knew I did everything I could while she was on this planet to make her life more comfortable. And that's a bit of powerful thing.
Yeah. That's not something that a lot of people can associate themselves with when losing someone. Which is where a lot of that regret and guilt comes in play, because you start thinking about all the things you could have done that you didn't do.
Yeah.
And then you see the people that have peace in death and you understand why. Well, you try to understand why, if you understand like that dynamic of relationship.
Yeah. So you honestly, like, it's difficult, but every time I think about my mom being gone, I hear the 11-year-old wishing for his mommy, but the 52-year-old knows intellectually and emotionally that that body was failing. So it relaxes me to know that she's no longer suffering.
Yeah.
And so I have to tell the 11-year-old, hey man, it's okay.
Yeah. So there's one of the guys I interviewed, his mom died recently. And he was saying that he didn't want condolences anymore because he realized that he had the best relationship for the 30 plus years of having his mom he could have ever had.
Yeah.
And he wanted to appreciate that instead of focusing on like this one moment of her being gone.
Exactly.
I think that's an amazing way to look at it.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about healing relationships or being the best you can, particularly in parental relationships, is once the person dies, the relationship goes on. It doesn't end. It doesn't end because they pass away. So if you can get it together with them before they're gone, that's optimal. But even after they've left, you can still heal the relationship that wasn't or could have been better.
And that's, you talk about forgiving yourself, which is like a very big thing with you, forgiving yourself and then like self-awareness, self-acceptance. Is a part of forgiving yourself forgiving others first, or do you forgive yourself first and then forgive others? Like, especially when it comes to that parent dynamic.
Yeah, I think forgiving myself for me was key. Because once I was able to be kinder, gentler, have more empathy and compassion for myself, then I could extend it to other people.
Okay.
I share a story in the book where my mom, who had suffered abuse at the hands of a family member, sexual trauma, and how she had managed to forgive the perpetrator. And I was furious with her for doing that, for offering forgiveness.
Yeah.
And you know, she said to me, oh, I didn't do it for him. I did it for me, because you weren't gonna have a mother on this planet anymore to take care of you if I kept harboring what I had to harbor.
Wow.
So those lessons are really what have me sitting with you today, those subtle, gentle, but powerful lessons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have a motto. Your worst decision was the best decision that you can make at that time.
Yeah.
Like that, when I read, I was like, it's deep.
Yeah.
Like when you think about it, but it's very real.
Mm-hmm.
Like you do the best you can at the moment that you're in that moment.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just really not the best decision.
Maybe. Or maybe it's the best decision that you could make at the time. You know, maybe given the resources that you have, the decision that you made was the best one at the time. And if you were then where you are now, maybe you can make a different choice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to look at that and have some compassion for the person who messed up, or maybe didn't mess up. Maybe that mistake you made is what set your life in the trajectory that it was destined to go with. I'm a 30-year survivor of being HIV positive. That diagnosis for me was what transformed me and made me realize I got to stop worrying about all these other people.
Yeah.
Because it's killing me now, because it affects the immune system when you take on other people's stuff, right? So what if those poor decisions, for lack of a better term, that I made that caused the contraction of the virus or not. You know, it's just a hypothesis. But that diagnosis set me on a completely different trajectory. And I wouldn't be sitting here with you today. I'd be a Delta flight attendant, living a great life, but not sharing what I've learned with the rest of the world.
Yeah. How important was that moment of realizing that you wanted to share your story with the world?
It's like a push and a pull, because you know you have something to contribute, but sometimes your ego will tell you, or in my case, nobody wants to hear that, or you're going to shame your family, or why would you put yourself out there like that? But once you start to do the work and realize, like I realize every day in a one-on-one capacity with the clients I work with in suicide and crisis prevention, once I realize that the sharing of myself isn't about me, it's about what God has brought through me to give to other people to maybe help them a little bit. So like with my mom, that's not about me anymore, because she needed to do what she needed to do to be okay. I needed to do what God was telling me to do so that other people could be okay and get out of my own way in order to make that happen.
Yeah. Are there moments where you're, again, just in that struggle of, I want to be more open, more vulnerable, but I need to kind of restrict some of this to myself, like can't give all of it to everyone?
Brother, I think it's too late. I think there's 110 pages just about, there are 110 pages for just about everything I've ever done that I at one point wasn't so proud of. So it's out there now, so I don't have to worry about that. I do think about, to be honest with you, could I get myself more in relationship capacities? I talk about a failed relationship in the book. And, you know, that's one of the things where, like, once you get burned once or a broken heart, it's hard to put yourself back out there and to go through that again.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm working on that piece. Maybe not.
Yeah.
But all the rest of it is no shame, no guilt. Just, you know, just the work that's supposed to be done.
I have a non-experienced philosophy on that part of relationships. It's like you get your heart broken and you have to go back and like love harder the next time and put yourself out there harder the next time and just allow yourself to go through the heartache and heartbreak from the next person if that happens.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that. I would add to that, that you do that, but you also take the lessons that you learn, because there was wisdom that was gained from that heartbreak.
Absolutely.
I know in my situation, I was so mad at the other person that I didn't stop to realize all the warning signs were there with this person. All the warning signs, you know, and you know, that's not on him. That's on me to pretend like it was okay, or I just ignored it or made it okay.
Yeah.
So that's the part about forgiving myself. I moved from being angry at him to realizing you got yourself into this. You saw all the signs.
Yeah.
You chose to ignore them. So once I forgave myself, it was easy to forgive him. I saw him one day in a clothing store. I was glad to see him. Don't want to talk to him. but it was easy. That's the beauty of forgiving yourself.
Yeah. Wow. So you finished the first book. Again, like you said, you put everything on the table, and then you do another one. What makes you go into a second book?
So there are so many things that are still left within me to contribute that may not have anything to do with that part of my journey. But, you know, as for example, the next book that I write will talk about the trials and tribulations that we face as Black men in the professional world. Racial microaggressions, jealousy, you know, having to be more social than you'd like to be when you're an introvert by nature, all of those things. So I feel that is the next book that is within me, because I remember just maybe 2 years ago, I suffered through racial microaggressions and I didn't realize it was happening until almost it was too late.
Wow.
And, you know, that's a lot to go through. It's a lot to deal with. And I think a lot of us face that. I said to a friend when I explained the story, what was going on, and the first thing my friend said, who's also professional, well, what'd she do, start crying? I said, exactly, how'd you know? It's a script, right?
And so a lot of us go through some of the same things.
It's the microaggressions are kind of like, you hear it and it's like,
right,
maybe I'm overthinking it.
Sure.
And then you talk to the friend who typically doesn't overthink, and they're like, nah, that's absolutely what just happened.
Right.
And it's, I get frustrated now, because it's, in my eyes, you have to know this is wrong. Like there's no way at this point in all of our lives with everything that we know that you can't know that what you just did was wrong. So why would you do that with that knowing Like, you understand something about what you did wasn't right.
I think that's an interesting perspective, and I don't disagree with you, but I also think that evil never thinks that evil is evil. You know what I'm saying? Like people who are doing evil acts, I don't think they always think that what I'm doing is out to destroy you. They're thinking about how it makes them feel to see you be brilliant, how it makes them feel to see you be outstanding, the feeling that they have, the jealousy that comes up, the envy, or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And so then they start acting on that, as opposed to, I'm evil and I'm gonna make your life, a living hell here at work. So they just start out, maybe. It's just a theory.
I'll try to give some of them the benefit of the doubt then. I'll try.
Yeah, I used to do that.
I'll try. TEDx.
Yes, sir.
When that happens, you know, like the platform that's becoming now, how does that happen? How does that feel?
It feels like water. It feels like what was supposed to happen. It feels like the moment that I've been preparing for 50 years, 51 years.
Yeah.
Particularly with this last year of my life, and so what I'll be talking about in TEDx is some of the things that we discussed here today, but it's what I've been talking about one-on-one with clients for over a decade, which is a couple of things, right? Like, your parents are human beings. Not people that owe you stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe they did owe you stuff, but you're not a kid anymore.
Yeah.
I had a young lady at work upset because we were talking about stuff, and she was saying she didn't get her dental work done when she was a kid because her mom didn't do X, Y, and Z. And I said to her, well, you have dental insurance valid, don't you? And you're 38, right?
Right. Stop playing your parents at that point.
At a certain point, you gotta let that go.
And which is an interesting thing. I have a lot of conversations with some friends and family that your parents, again, like you said, they're human beings. They're not Superman and Superwoman.
Right.
They made the best decision they knew how to make at that moment.
Right.
And sometimes it wasn't the best decision, but that's what they had.
Right.
So they worked with what they had to try to do the best they can. And sometimes it was wrong. Sometimes it failed. And they had to fix it and try to pick it back up again. But being, again, late 30s, 40s, and still holding on to 11-year-old issues, it's hard to kind of process as an adult.
It can be. But, I always say to my clients, there's a payoff for every behavior that we have. So if you're blaming your mom for why you didn't get your teeth fixed, the payoff is you don't have to be accountable for why your teeth are not fixed.
Right.
You get to blame somebody else for why your life isn't going. That's just a metaphor, but blaming somebody. You get the luxury of blaming somebody else for why things aren't going the way you think that they should be going.
Yeah,
it doesn't really move the ball forward. I tell you this: I'm 52. My parents were married and had me at 21 and 20 years old. And if you put a baby in my arms right now, I'd be scared out of my mind. And I've got a lot of knowledge and some pretty emotional maturity.
Yeah.
So to expect them to have the wisdom at 21 and 22. That I now have at 51 is like, I often say, it's like expecting George Washington to know what Wi-Fi is. What would George Washington know about Wi-Fi, sir? Like, it's not part of his existence, part of his world.
Yeah.
Much like the things that we're talking about in terms of self-care and mental health awareness may not have been a part of my parents' trajectory at 20 and 21.
I absolutely could not imagine being 20 with a kid. Like, when I look at what my 20s and 30s was, God knew not to put a child in my life. Like, it wasn't the time.
Yeah.
And again, my mom's the same way. She was 21 when you had me. My dad was 24. Mm-hmm. My kids. And as an adult now, looking back at that, I now understand why some of those arguments happened and why some of those struggles were there.
Yeah.
Your kids.
And the beauty of it is, my dad is still here. And some of the best discussions we have is just when I let him be himself. And offer, if he's open to it, a different way of thinking about things. And he said to me, if anybody else had said that to me, I would have punched him in the face. And I was like, I'm not coming from a place where I'm trying to do anything other than speak to you as man to man. Mm-hmm. And he respects that and appreciates that. And I can see him trying to make the adjustments at 73 years old.
Yeah.
So there's always hope.
Yeah.
But you have to approach with love and not a place of you owe me this or why didn't you do this. It has to come from a place of love and respect for the adult. You're an adult, respect the adult that you're talking to.
And that's hard.
It can be.
That's pretty much where a lot of the challenge comes in at.
It can.
It's because there's that, for most people that have that absentee father situation, mm-hmm. there's that anger in there that you want to be upset, but you really want that relationship to work, mm-hmm. but you can't stop being upset about not having it previously. Mm-hmm. So you struggle in that space of trying to be respectful and letting go of anger and frustration at the same time.
Yeah.
That's a difficult space to kind of live in.
Well, I'll tell you what helped me with both of my parents is when I stopped to think about that at some point, you know, I've been their baby. I was my mother's baby, right? But at some point, she was somebody's baby.
Mm-hmm.
She started out, you know, at some point he was somebody's baby. And so whatever happened to him between there and when he had me, I have to ask and respect that because it's what made him who he was and may have shaped some of the decisions that he made that I thought should have been different before we started talking about them.
Yeah.
But when you start talking to people, like particularly dads, I thought my dad was absent when I'm living in poverty in San Francisco. And he may have been not physically present, but then he began to explain to me the dynamics with my mom and also tearfully told me what it feels like to be a man to have his kids ripped away from him.
Wow. Which isn't a conversation that's had.
No.
But you gotta ask, what was that like for you? Tell me what that was like for you.
Yeah. Typically, men in those situations don't really get questioned about the emotional aspect of what that looks like. It's mm-hmm. just kind of, you're at fault. Here's your child support amount. Mm-hmm. Make your payments or go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a conversation about emotional and mental health standings with them.
No, and I think depending on where your dad is, or in the general sense, where our dads are, if you want to have that conversation, it can't be, hey, let me talk to you about your mental health. You know,
it can't be. What? Like, already, this is what's going, right?
Yeah.
But it can be a conversation of, hey, man, I'm struggling with this. What did you do at this age when you were struggling with some of the same stuff?
Yeah. Just open a door.
Open the door.
Wow. So, what's next for you after all of this? The books, TEDx coming up, your journey thus far. Like, what do you want to happen next? Like, where do you want your story to go?
I want my story to help as many people as I can, as they can. But whenever I talk, I always want people to know my story is the template, but it's not about my story as much as it is about the lessons and the technology that I'm able to impart that emerge from those stories, that wisdom, right?
Yeah.
And so moving forward, I'm doing the TED Talk this weekend, and then most likely creating a podcast and definitely continuing on with the public speaking tour and the other book that I told you about, and continuing to work as a mental health clinician in the DC area one-on-one with clients. So yeah. There's a lot still happening and unfolding, but I'm open to it. I mean, if you had told me 3 years ago that I'd be sitting here with you discussing my book or TED Talk, I would have been looking around like green.
So nice.
You know, everything's possible.
Yeah.
Mind it.
Nice. Well, again, wish you the best. I think it's an important conversation. So I think there's a lot of people that can take something from it.
Yeah.
Even if it's not the same story, there's a lot of principle in there that can help. So
it's not about what happens to you. It's about how you respond to it.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true. All right. Thank you, man.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
Always.
Thank you.